Our country's highest mountain peak, east of the Rockies, stands in South Dakota. This peak was called Hinhankanga, or Owl Maker, after the rock formations that look like owls, and the association of owls with impending death by the Lakota Sioux. They considered it a sacred site within the Black Hills. The mountain was named Harney Peak in 1855 in honor of U.S. General William S. Harney. In punitive retaliation for other Sioux raids, in September of that year, Harney's forces killed Sioux warriors, women, and children in what was called the Battle of Blue Water Creek, or the Battle of Ash Hollow, or the Harney Massacre. After at least 50 years of appeals, in 2014, the Sioux renewed their efforts to change the name of the mountain. With an effort led by Basil Braveheart of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, a Korean War veteran, he felt that Harney had not honored the military with his action. When attempts to persuade the government to change the mountain's name back to Hinhankanga failed, the Lakota Council of the Pine Ridge Reservation and the descendants of Black Elk, a noted medicine man, supported naming it for him. Black Elk became known beyond the Lakota in part through the book Black Elk Speaks. The National Wilderness Area around the peak was already named for the shaman. Black Elk said of his vision on that mountain, "I was standing on the highest mountain of them all, and round about beneath me was the whole hoop of the world. While I stood there, I saw more than I can tell, and I understood more than I saw. For I was seeing in a sacred manner the shapes of all things in the spirit, and the shape of all shapes, as they must live together like one being." The U.S. Board on Geographic Names officially changed the mountain's name from Harney Peak, so named for more than 150 years, to Black Elk Peak on August 11, 2016, by a unanimous vote of 12 to 0.
It has been another trying year. I try to keep things in perspective as best I can, but that is difficult for me because I don't really see an end. 12 years ago, just after Christmas, I was living in Rapid City, South Dakota. My pager woke me up sometime after 2 a.m. The wind howled as I checked the message. An aircraft had gone down in the winter weather, so I pulled on my boots and gear and made my way to the search and rescue barn. I didn't know where I was going yet, but I knew where I needed to start. I lived close, and I was the first one to the barn. I was still new to the team, though, so I stood there in the empty parking lot in the blowing snow, looking at a building full of rescue gear, just waiting to be warmed up and put to use. But I didn't have the key to get in. Everyday problems are like this as well. I find myself rushing to fix things, only to find that I don't have what it takes to fix them. Sometimes, oftentimes, we just need a little help to get us moving. Even with all the tools at our disposal, many problems require the help of others to overcome. But the interconnected web of existence works both ways. We can use the tools that we do have access to help those around us. trying to solve problems that don't directly affect us. We can send support to those still fighting fires in California, or those rebuilding in Puerto Rico, or any of a depressingly large number of worthy causes around the country and around the world. We can help more locally with organizations like Loudoun Volunteer Caregivers. And for connection with those around us, it really can't get more literal than giving blood. The Red Cross is facing a severe shortage this winter, as September and October have passed with far fewer donations than needed. Before I get overwhelmed with the amount of need in the world, I find it necessary to remind myself that I can't do it all myself. That day back at the rescue barn, our team lead, Rick, was the next to arrive. He swept through the building, getting the facility ready for the next arrivals, and helping me prep the first truck. We found out it was fortunately a small twin-engine aircraft with one person on board. A mechanic had called it in, and he had seen the aircraft miss its first approach, and it never came back around. It was too windy, and the visibility was too poor to send up Civil Air Patrol to get a look from the sky, so we would be relying on a handheld emergency beacon locator. That would be my job in the passenger seat of the first truck. Large aircraft tend to have higher power transmitters, and they also transmit their locations as they travel along. VHF radio signals don't travel very well through the hills of the Badlands. This was about 20 miles from what is now Black Elk Peak, then still called Harney Peak. This was shaping to be a long night. Sometimes small problems are more difficult to handle than large ones. They each present their own challenges. A small problem can take more time to troubleshoot. The decision of how much effort and risk to accept when addressing a problem becomes difficult to make. How many people should you put in harm's way to save one life? My other jobs in the passenger seat of that truck were to operate the radio and the GPS. I punched in the coordinates where the mechanic had last seen the flight, and as we drove to the airport. If we were going to go north of the runway, we were going to need to cut through a farmer's barbed wire fence. For that, the authorities would have to contact the farmer. After about 10 minutes of driving as fast as the gravel roads would allow, we came to a dead stop. We waited for the sheriff's office to call and then send someone to the owner's house to get permission. I was really hoping we would just clip it and move on. Were we really going to halt the search over a thread of fence? We were in a rescue vehicle, after all. It wasn't like we lacked the resources. But even though we knew someone was on the other side of the fence and in need, we had to wait. We had to make sure the field was safe to travel on, or we risk ourselves. And not only removing ourselves from the number of rescuers available, but removing those that would have to come to our aid as well. We also needed to make sure that we wouldn't be letting loose some herd of livestock that could spill over the dirt roads and onto the nearest highway and cause fatal car accidents in the reduced visibility. I think it's important here not to confuse discretion with passivity. The dispatch office and the sheriff were at that moment doing everything in their power to make contact with the farmer, and it felt an act of faith of us to let them do their job. We were all a team, and we were all sharing the progress, even if I couldn't see it from the cab of the truck. I have come to view this decision of whether or not to break through that fence without the consent of the farmer as similar to the decision of whether or not to take violent action to solve a problem. If we view violence as a tool to effect change, we risk believing it can solve the problem. Just like cutting the fence, violence doesn't really solve the problem, it changes it. I suppose the natural follow-up question is, what if it was a larger airplane that was in need? In terms of violence, what if we're talking about the lead up to World War II? It's a question I've asked myself before. As a high school exchange student, I stood within the walls of Dachau in Germany. I've been in the shower room, which was reportedly never used in that facility. And I've been in the crematorium, which was. I've asked myself what I would have done. And after returning to the States from Germany, I entered my enlistment later that same summer. I try to do the best that I can. I saw then a violence as a tool then, a means to an end. Since then, I've only seen it result in more and more violence. After separating from the military, I went to college. There, I was asked to participate in a focus group, talking about the response to 9/11, among other things. The students around me were mostly of the turn the desert into a glass parking lot mentality. My question to them was, what is the exchange rate for human life? How many of them do we need to kill to bring back our dead? The students at this particular school often come from a Christian background and invoke an eye for an eye from the Bible in Leviticus. But to do this, one needs to first ignore the New Testament, where the book of Matthew follows it up with, but turn the other cheek. Even so, one needs to assign blame for the actions of the now deceased perpetrators to those men, women, and children who would ultimately succumb to our bombs. In 1953, President Eisenhower gave his Chance for Peace speech following the death of Joseph Stalin. At that time, 19-year-old Basil Braveheart had already been serving in a combat unit in Korea as the Korean War was approaching an armistice. In the president's speech, Eisenhower lists the precepts which govern our actions of our country. The first, he says, is this: no people on earth can be held as a people to be an enemy. For all humanity shares the common hunger for peace and fellowship and justice. To me, that resonates pretty well with the UU principle of inherent worth and dignity of every person. Eisenhower had been elected fairly recently following his service as a general in World War II. And in this speech, Eisenhower discusses the prospects of an arms race and its cost if chosen as the tool to prevent the unbridled aggressive power that was seen in the war. He said, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, and the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete highway. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This, I repeat, is the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. The words of Dr. Martin Luther King are no stranger to our ears or the walls of this church. In his last book, alongside Violence Begets Violence and Hate Begets Hate, Dr. King differentiated between using violence in defense when one's person and home are attacked, because such defense action is guaranteed by common law, and contrast it with violence used as a tool to be prepared and used while trying to make progress. He wrote, "It is dangerous to organize a movement around self-defense. The line of demarcation between defensive violence and aggressive violence is very thin. The minute a program of violence is enunciated, even for self-defense, the atmosphere is filled with the talk of violence, and the words falling on unsophisticated ears may be interpreted as an invitation to aggression. Dr. King also warns of those who confuse nonviolence with passivity, and those who use it to quiet down protesters, but then turn around and celebrate and defend violent action in other situations, like the Vietnam War, where more black men were dying in combat than would be representative of their population. It still holds today that African Americans represent a higher percentage of our military force than they do in the nation as a whole. Dr. King writes that nonviolence is not just a passive acceptance of the current situation. True nonviolence, he says, is more than absence of violence. It is the persistent and determined application of peaceable power to offenses against the community. In the 1930s, the U.S. was in a state of passive acceptance. According to the State Department's own account of the events, the U.S. Congress passed a series of neutrality acts in the 1930s to keep the U.S. out of a global fight. We seem to be trying to enforce simply the absence of violence on our shores. In 1940, we began to provide aid to the nations at war with the Axis powers, and we instituted the first peacetime draft in our history. A year later, an attack on our people and home brought us fully into the war. I pay taxes to my government, even though they have used and continue to use violent means to address issues worldwide. The practical answer to that apparent hypocrisy is that I live here, and it is the law of the land. But I also do it because I still believe in the democratic process. I still believe we are making progress, and I am participating in that progress. I still support the public good that comes from a functioning government by, of, and for the people. One such good is emergency services. Back in that rescue truck, sitting by the fence, we waited. Snowflakes fell into and out of the headlights, winking into and out of existence, marking each passing moment. That farmer was helping the best he could, and just as I was helping the best I could in these moments. I needed to trust that he was doing his part, and together we were making progress little by little, and it didn't seem like it at the time, but we were getting there. After what felt like hours, but was probably minutes, the fence was cleared. Rick had me switch on the beacon locator and locate the aircraft's emergency beacon. The beacon is an alarm that it should be sending out over the radio. He said, "I'm driving. You tell me where to go." I used the GPS to give us direction, but the beacon locator gave us nothing but static. No indication of where the actual crash site was. We seemed to be traveling through eternity, large, bright snowflakes passing like an endless supply of shooting stars out to the edge of the windshield. Dispatch called with an update. The pilot was alive and was able to make contact with his company. They had a new set of GPS coordinates for us. He hadn't landed past the runway like the mechanic had thought. Instead, he had come all the way back around for another pass and landed short of the runway. We were miles away and pointed in the wrong direction. At the time, I remember it felt like we were further from the solution than we were before. In reality, the plane didn't move once it hit the ground. Only now did we have the clarity of understanding our problem. Only now did we understand just how far we always were. It was progress that brought us to this point. It was not wasted effort. Sometimes you need to go down the wrong path just a little ways before you know what the right path even is. And in hindsight, had we burst through that fence at the first opportunity, we would have had more time to unwittingly drive the wrong direction than even far further afield and even further from a resolution. I put the new coordinates in the GPS, and we backtracked and corrected our course. When the chirping alarm started coming across the beacon locator, we were less than 1,000 feet away. We slowed down, and soon the plane came into view. We got out of the truck and saw the pilot walking towards us, his eyes blinking in the wind and headlights. He said, "Boy, am I glad to see you." We agreed. He was in a truck and on his way to the hospital in minutes. And time had returned to its more familiar and steady tempo. Along the way, it seemed like endless stretches of waiting and backtracking, punctuated by just moments of progress. When we're forced to take those breaks, though, to stop and consider our next move, or to consider our last move, no matter how much we hate it in the moment, it becomes clear afterwards that it was a necessary step in the progress towards our ultimate solution. Even in my daily tasks at work, when faced with a particularly challenging problem, I force myself to take a step away from the problem. I deliberately stop trying to make progress for just a moment as a way of helping clarify what progress and solution even means for this task. This has saved me from pursuing dead ends to their conclusion and gave me time to see the problem in the context of all the progress that I've made so far. That additional context can help make the solution more achievable, and not always through the means that I originally thought. Seeking and accepting help is another necessity for some problems, and this one I find even more difficult to employ. We need to acknowledge that we can't necessarily solve every problem by ourselves. Our progress towards the solution might rely on the efforts of another person. That is not a negative reflection of our own capabilities, but a reflection of the complexity of the problem and the associated solution. A reflection of the interconnected web of existence. I think it's also important to remind ourselves that we stay committed to moving forward, even after our immediate problem is solved. Moving in fits and starts, and even backtracking sometimes along the way. Basil Braveheart, who would play a key role in changing the name of a mountain, was in 2006 a Lakota teacher and healer in the Pine Ridge Reservation, only a few miles away from the site of the crash. He had spent years battling alcoholism and trauma from his experience in the Korean War. That snowy night, 25 miles and 10 years away from Black Elk Peak, none of us were done moving forward.